This is the Bat Pod. Bat Pod.
Grab your bat microphone. It's time to start the show. Like a court of owls, the mystery is starting to grow. Let there be no debate. It's about to begin. Keen like Bruce Wayne, quick like Tim Drake, fierce like Damien. Grab your headphones, listen up, you know you love it. Drop the facade. Like the Dark Knight detective, they've got some perspective. They're a pure crime-fighting collective. It's the Bat Pod.
Welcome to the Bat Pod. My name is Bill Beer. Joining us tonight, Martin Ferretti and Jay Loving.
Brian Edward Hill knows how to properly pronounce Ra's al Ghul.
He does. He uses Ra's.
Yes, that was a very clear indication.
How's it going, Jay?
Going well.
Good. So, if you're joining us for the first time, the Bat Pod, we always talk about new releases of Batman, Detective Comics, and one other book. And this week, I actually did something a little different. I put a poll on Twitter and asked what that third book would be. And the book that got voted in was Batman and the Outsiders number 2.
I want you to know that I rigged that poll and had my Twitter followers all vote Batman and the Outsiders.
Oh, I'm sure you did. I'm sure you did.
I did.
You probably took the poll down and rigged it somehow where nobody could see it except for you. And
I am Mr. Robot. Yes,
yeah,
that's true.
Yeah. The other books we're going to do tonight is Batman number 73 and Detective Comics 1005. Are you guys ready to talk some Batman comics?
Yes.
Always.
So let's get to the books.
The Batpod is a spoiler podcast. Please read the comics we're reviewing so you can enjoy the show.
We are a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network.
Okay, our first book is Batman number 53. Your writer is Tom King. Mikel Yanin is your artist. Colorist, Jordi Belair. Letter, Clayton Cowles. Cover, Mikel Yanin. Variant cover, Ben Oliver. Associate editor, Rob Levin, and editor, Jamie S. Rich. And in this issue, Batman and his dad go on a vacation in the desert. Not really. Flashpoint Batman has Bruce on a horse dragging a coffin. Yeah, that's right, a coffin through the desert. They meet some ninjas from Ra's al Ghul's Death Squad.
Who? I don't know who that is. Is that a new villain?
No, it's not.
I've never heard of Ra's al Ghul, sorry.
Ra's al Ghul's Death Squad in the desert. And Bruce wakes up and you find out that everything happened. Everything happened in the last issue. It wasn't a dream. At least we don't think it's a dream so far. It still could be a dream possible. But you find out that, you know, Daddy is going to revive his mother in a new Lazarus pit. And that's how the issue ends. If we learn one thing from reading this particular issue, it's that if you thought Bruce Wayne's father was off his rocker before, now it's totally horror movie off his rocker.
Yes.
And I tell you, reading this at first, he's singing Home on the Range, Flashpoint Batman is, throughout the whole, basically the whole issue. And I'm reading this, and when I first see that, I don't think it's a coffin to me. I didn't recognize it as a coffin. It didn't even appear to me that it was a coffin. I thought it was like, you know, a chest of some kind that they were carrying something. But then as we got further in the book, I'm like, maybe that is a coffin. And then when we got to the very end and we find out, yeah, their whole goal is to go to the secret Lazarus pit and revive his mother so they all can be a family again, which is really, really messed up.
Yeah. So I don't know how secret this Lazarus pit is. It's in Kadeem, which is where, I mean, we'll talk about that when we get to Batman and the Outsiders.
Yeah.
When Talia showed up in the Silencer a few months ago, she mentioned the Lazarus Pit in Kadeem as well. So I don't know how secret it is, because it's popping up everywhere. I did not realize that Martha was going to be in the coffin, and I will ask, how the hell is Martha here? My initial thought was that Thomas was taking Bruce out to the desert to bury him in his coffin.
Okay.
Because he's been working with Bane the whole time. But I guess maybe that's not the case.
No, that's not the case. My biggest question is, which Martha is this? Is it the Martha? You know what I'm saying?
I do. Just all. Martin, you had the question, how the hell is Martha here? I'm still trying to figure out the answer to the question. How the hell is Thomas Wayne here? I know you call him in the Flashpoint, Thomas Wayne, but I'm still not understanding how he's back in this reality, because this is not Flashpoint reality.
Correct.
No, and, you know, I keep saying Flashpoint Batman because that's what we know the costume from, but things that happen in the DC universe, especially lately, it could be Bruce Wayne from any Earth, any reality.
Yes.
You know, because it's never been said since he's back and we've seen him that he's that particular Thomas Wayne.
That's true. Now, I'm sure there's some reason why he's here. I can somehow buy that he made it to our Earth through some machinations. What I can't buy is that in this coffin would be the Flashpoint or some other universe Martha Wayne, right?
No,
like,
probably
to
not.
Me, it seems like it has to be our world's Martha Wayne. In which case, I mean, I don't know, man. I don't recall all the Lazarus Pit stories. She's been dead for like decades. So does the Lazarus Pit work if she's been gone for decades? Because I assumed you still had to be like freshly dead.
Well, that's how it's supposed to be, the regular Lazarus Pit. I think this is a special one, you know, they've been saving. You know, because once you use a Lazarus Pit, isn't it, like, done?
Yeah.
So, I'm thinking that this one will return someone that's been dead a while. It's more powerful or something. We don't really have an explanation, but that's what I'm thinking.
Very possible. I hadn't thought of it in that respect, but yeah.
Maybe it's a clone of Martha Wayne, like we saw in, what's the book that we talked about last episode?
The Last Night on Earth?
Yeah, The Last Night on Earth. There you go. Maybe it's a clone of Martha Wayne. Maybe this Lazarus Pit in Kadeem is what we see there.
Well, if you all remember a good 10 years ago or so, that Dick Grayson tried to put a Bruce Wayne skeleton in a Lazarus Pit?
After R.I.P.?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And when he came back, it was like a crazy,
zombie-like.
Right.
Because it wasn't really Bruce Wayne. It was some
faux
character that they substituted.
Yeah. I mean, but he wasn't in his right mind.
You know what I think? I think the three of us read way too many comics, and we're trying to find an explanation for this. And it's probably some, like, brand new thing.
I'm sure it is. And, you know, the one thing I got to say about this Tom King run is, no, I haven't been enjoying the whole thing. But there are some new things being introduced in here that I've actually enjoyed. I actually enjoyed this issue.
Yeah, I actually, matter of fact, I messaged you guys.
Yep.
Because as soon as I read this, I was like, huh, I'm pretty sure that I like this issue. Actually, that's not what I said. But it was something to that effect. Because I did, actually. I really enjoyed it. I am a fan of Thomas Wayne. So when he pops up in a story, which is very rarely, I enjoy seeing that. And I agree. I like these new elements being thrown in. In particular, this one. And, this reminded me a little bit of Last Night on Earth, which is maybe why I really enjoyed it, because I love Last Night on Earth. We've also seen this, like, Batman on a horse thing before in the series, right? So I am wondering if this is a callback to that. And I can't remember what issue it was, but I'm pretty sure it's been quite a while. I think it was before issue 50.
Yeah, it was, like, in the 30s, the early 30s.
Yeah. Yep, where Batman was on the horse. So that has me wondering, like, whether there is some hallucination stuff going on here or not. You know, I feel like if they're actually going to Kadeem to this new Lazarus Pit, are we going to see Ra's al Ghul show up? In which case, like, how many more characters can we pop into the story and, you know, kind of get the spotlight away from Bane? I want that Bane story to be dealt with. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's been
introducing more and more elements.
I'm just agreeing. Yeah, that because we've got what, two more issues before, or is it 75 that starts City of Bane?
Yeah.
Yes.
So we got one more issue before we start that storyline, and kind of what are we building up to with all this? Well, I'm sure this is connected, since Tom King had this entire story of 100 issues sort of plotted out. So it's got to tie in somewhere, but, you know, I'm expecting a lot of things in issue 74. Hopefully it'll be explained.
Yeah, we haven't got a lot of explanation about much, only in, like, panels.
I did see on Twitter this past week, somebody tweeted Tom King and said, are we going to get an explanation as to how exactly Thomas Wayne is in this reality? And he said yes.
Well, that's good.
So,
Dr. Manhattan did it.
Well, the other thing, you wonder why Bruce is walking around. And we get to that one panel where he basically, in one word balloon, he explains that he did the best to put his spine back together. You know, if his back was really broken, are we to believe it was broke, or I don't know. We don't know what the time frame is that this, assume it's not that long, maybe a month.
Look, it is no secret that I have not been the biggest fan of this run. However, I still, you know, trot along and read it because it's Batman. It's been my favorite character for years. Let me tell you, when issue 85 comes around, if this whole thing is a goddamn nightmare, I'm going to be so pissed.
I agree. That would be a cheap way out.
Yeah, I don't think I would like that too much because everything that we've invested in didn't happen.
Yeah.
And to just follow up on what Martin says, you know, I've been a fan of Tom King's run, not necessarily because I believe it's the best Batman that's ever been written, not necessarily believing that the story is absolutely coherent and doesn't have some issues. It kind of touches back on what you said earlier about how he's introducing different elements. And we have a character that's 80 years old, you know, and I've been reading since, gosh, you know, age 10 or 11. What I'm enjoying about this is the different elements. Even if they don't make sense to me sometimes, even if I don't think it's the best way to treat the character, it just that is fascinating to me to see what he's doing with this character.
I'll give you that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, slow, but that's been some issues that I've not liked very well, while others, there have been others that I really like. This is one of the ones that kind of shocked me that I really enjoyed. And, you know, he was singing that song, Home on the Range, which, what do you think the, I know I'm thinking a little bit too much about this, but what do you think that represents?
Tom King loves Roy Rogers.
It was not actually done by Roy Rogers.
Oh, really?
No, it was originally written by Dr. Brewster Higley of South Smith Country, Kansas. And it was a poem, My Western Home, in 1872. In 1947, it became the state song of Kansas. And in 2010, it was voted the Western Writers of America one of the top 100 songs.
I don't know. I didn't try to read any meaning into the choice of the song.
Yeah, it made you think that, yeah, he's relaxed and got a clear head and he has a goal in mind and he's going to get his family back together.
Mm-hmm.
Which he's clearly insane because that will never happen.
Or will it?
I guess we'll find out. So, of course, the art in this issue is stunning and spectacular as always. I even really like the variant cover. It was kind of interesting. A little dark.
Yep.
But yeah, I liked the variant cover.
Yeah, it's extremely minimal too, right? Because they're just walking through the desert, so it's all about the characters and not what's going on in the background. And I think that's also different, right, than old school Batman. Well, I don't want to say old school, but like a lot of Batman stories. In particular, I would say like through the 80s and 90s and into the 2000s, like the background is just as much a character as what you see on the forefront.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm ready for a new Batman, you know, on the cover where it says Batman. I'm ready for a redesign for that. Because we've had that around since like 2012, I believe. Or 11.
Yeah, you're ready for Dick Grayson Batman. I agree.
No.
Me too.
Not at all.
Sign me up. But yeah, this logo's been around since, well, they changed it when started the new 52. So yeah, 2012, I think.
Yeah. You guys remember when they used to do, who was it that did it? Neil Adams. When Neil Adams was doing covers back in the, this might be like a Silver Age topic discussion. But when Neil Adams was doing the covers during the 70s, he always had like a different logo on there. You guys remember that? That was freaking awesome. And like he made the logos part of whatever the action of the cover was.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that was pretty cool.
That's fantastic.
So anything else to add about this particular book here?
No, I dug it quite a bit, actually.
Okay. Yep, me too. So we'll head on to topic of the week.
Who is this guy?
I'm Batman.
You could be Batman.
Sure.
I'm Batman.
See?
I'm Batman.
You sound like Cookie Monster.
I'm Batman. That's Batman.
I'm Batman.
Listen, I'm Batman.
Oof, you even sound like a bad guy.
I swear I am a good guy.
Okay, Mr. Batman.
Batman?
Batman.
That's what I said, Batman.
No, you're saying Batman. Listen, I'm Batman.
I'm Batman.
I want you to tell all your friends about me.
What are you?
I'm Batman.
Welcome to Topic Up of the Week. And the topic this week is three of our favorite Silver Age comics.
Yeah!
So, Jay, you're up first.
Okay. Detective Comics 341. This is back when they were doing multiple stories, or two stories, or sometimes three in an issue. But the story that was in this was The Joker's Comedy of Capers, written by John Broom and... Pencils was by the great Carmine Infantino. This is one of the silliest damn stories ever written, and that's why it appeals to me, because the premise of it is Joker is – there's a wealthy millionaire who loves the old slapstick comedies from the 30s, and he's seen all of them, so he commissions this movie producer to make some new ones. Well, the movie producer's the Joker in disguise. So the Joker devises this plan of crimes that are – staged as these, you know, slapstick comedy things that he's actually using Batman as one of and Robin are characters in there. And he does these various robberies doing disguised as some of the famous comedians from that area. Charlie Chaplin, Harpo Marx, a couple more that I recognize, but I don't remember their names. And it's just, I thought it was cleverly done about the writing was, this is back when with the Comics Code, and it was about the time of the Batman TV show, so everything was really kind of camp and silly. And he used that idea to play into that. There's just something – there's one funny scene that's funny as hell where Joker has a cannon that fires pies and hits people in the face. Childish as hell, but I'm still laughing at it.
Yeah, this is actually – this is what the kids nowadays call a minor key. Because it's the redesign of the Batman logo.
Yes.
It's got the first appearance of the yellow oval logo.
Yes.
For Batman. This is fun. I actually read this trying to decide what I wanted to pick tonight. This is actually one of the ones that I read. It's great. I love Silver Age comics.
I do.
I think Silver Age comics are extremely underrated. And I think very few people reading Batman now read Silver Age books because a lot of them just are so, we'll just say dumb. They're very silly. They work really well, you know what I mean? Like, they do what a comic is supposed to do. It's like, just give you a good time for 10 or 15 minutes. Back then, it's probably less, right? Because these books had, like, 8-page stories.
Right.
But yeah, this is a, it's a good one.
Now, this was another book that I had read as we were thinking about what books we want. But yeah, these Silver Age stories, and I have not read a ton of Silver Age stories, so it's really interesting reading a lot of these, especially if you have the DC app. There's a ton of these on there, and they're just fun. They're totally different than the stories that we're getting today, but they're a lot of fun, you know, especially if you're a big fan of, like, the Batman 66 TV series. You absolutely get where they were going with that. So I enjoyed this one a lot.
Mm-hmm. And I got to say, you know, in our Twitter chat, Jay asked about the dates. And because I think, Jay, you were looking at a couple that maybe were outside of the Silver Age.
A little bit earlier, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit earlier. So as I told you guys, I read about 50 comics to try to figure out what I wanted to read for this episode. And the more I read, the more I realized I think Batman may fall outside of that theme. Because Silver Age would be like, what, 56 to 70, right?
Yes.
That's not right?
That's typically what they say.
So I would say that might be true for comics in general, but in terms of Batman books, you can probably go like early 40s and it still reads like a Silver Age book. Because, you know, like the art style and the writing doesn't really change much after DC decides that, like, Batman's not going to be the purple guy with a gun. There's really not much in terms of the way the stories are told or how the art is portrayed on the page that changes really until 1970.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know, like, how much you guys have read out of that, how much the listeners of the show have read out of that. But I think, Jay, for this, we probably really could have gone very much earlier. Like, I would say even, like, 42, 43, you can consider that like a Silver Age for Batman.
Well, the two stories that I had talked about were, I think, from 51 and 52. And if you looked at them, they're no different in style and tone than the ones I'd picked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, they're just like a few years earlier. So I agree with you, though, that you could probably push that lower end. For Batman, you could push that down at least a dozen, at least 10 years, if not more.
And I'm going to say you can push the Bronze Age and Batman up like a year. And I'll talk about that when I do my last pick.
Yeah, I can see that totally. Not a big difference between story. I mean, really, if you draw a line of where those years are, there's no difference between the ones years before and the what we're talking about in that window. So,
yep. Yeah, I mean, thematically, the only difference in a Batman book is you start seeing like aliens and weird creatures in every episode, in every issue.
Yeah.
Right. So they're just replace a mobster with an alien, and bam, you're in Silver Age. Like, that's how Batman works. And that's not true for other comics.
Nope, it's not.
Now, of course, if you changed the Silver Age dates for Batman, the hardcore collectors would scream because, yeah, that would change all the first – that would change all the first appearance – the first Silver Age appearance of a number of characters. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, Martin, what's your number three?
Oh, man, this is tough. I wanted to make this my number one, but the more I thought about it, the more I realized this had to be a little further down on the list. My number three is Batman number 134, written by Bill Finger with pencils by Sheldon Moldoff. It's the Rainbow Creature. I would say one of the more iconic covers of the 60s. Mm-hmm. It's this giant creature with four colors, right? Red, yellow, green, and blue. And you have Batman and Robin kind of being thrown away from the creature in two dimensions because that's one of the creature's powers. So they're like paper dolls of Batman and Robin floating through the cover. And that does kind of come up in the issue as well. It takes place in an undisclosed South American country. And one thing that I always tell everyone, I always like recommending like Golden Age and Silver Age books to people, because I think it's important as a comic fan to read old stuff to get a feel for like where these things come from. But the one thing about Golden Age and Silver Age books is there's a lot of misogyny, a lot of racism, but not like – well, sometimes it is overt. But it's not like meant as a harmful thing, right? That's just – culture was very different in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. So if you can put some of that aside when you read these stories, you really can get a lot out of it. And the reason I say that is because – I mean, yes, it's called the Rainbow Creature. Technically, the villain is not the Rainbow Creature. It's like a generic Spanish guy, and he looks like a conquistador from like the 1500s would, right? Except this is modern times. So he's wearing like a conquistador metal helmet and chainmail, but, you know, it looks like this is happening, you know, late 1800s, early 1900s. This him and his crew are kind of accosting the president of this country because they want to take over the country. And it just so happens that when he starts doing this kind of revolution, this rainbow creature shows up. And the rainbow creature is a monster that has stripes of color down his body. Like I said, red, yellow, green, and blue. And each one of these colors signifies a power that the monster has. And so, you know, all the villagers are afraid of this guy because, you know, right before he attacks, the rainbow creature shows up and wreaks havoc on the town. And the president's very concerned, so he calls Batman and Robin to come in to defeat this guy and the rainbow creature. You know, it's Batman through his detecting skills that figures out that, well, the rainbow creature has nothing to do with this guy. It's a creature that's been living under a volcano for millennia, and it just so happens that he got out now, and he's trying to protect himself. And he's also the one that figures out a way to stop the creature from continuing to wreak havoc. And the way he does it is very simple. I can't recall like the exact powers because I don't take notes, but each power does something different. Like one will turn things two-dimensional. One is used to, like, break through walls. One is exclusively for vehicles. Like, it stops vehicles on their tracks. So if this creature's, like, thousands of years old, I don't know, like, why it's got a power to stop vehicles, but it does. And so Batman finds a way to have the creature use all four powers at once. And when he does, all the color escapes his body. So it's just black and white. Basically, him and Batman and Robin jab a giant pencil into the creature, and the creature blows up. And I think it's I think this is one of the most like stereotypical Silver Age stories, and that's why I picked it. Again, I love the cover, but like the way events unfolded the story, it's just like classic Silver Age Batman, and so it's perfect. Right. And, you know, sci-fi was huge in the mid-50s and the 60s. So it makes perfect sense that this would happen. And I love it. You know, it's super cheesy, super campy, but it, you know, it shows Batman's detective skills. And I love it. Plus, Grant Morrison used the rainbow creature in one of his runs. So two of my three picks actually tie into Grant Morrison. Because Grant Morrison, I love you.
Very cool. I haven't actually read that one, but it sounds like something I need to read. So.
It's so good.
Yeah.
And you got to remember, back then, the books were 8 pages, 9 pages.
Yeah.
Right? So it's very easy to read these and hop in and out.
Yeah, yeah. We will get on to my number three. And my number three is a book that has giant robots, monsters, volcanoes, and Batmite. My book is World Finest, number 113 from November 1960, and it's titled Batmite Meets Mitzel Picklick. And I know you all read this one, am I right?
As a matter of fact, yes, I did.
I have to.
This is classic Batmite and Mitzel Picklick and Superman Batman. That's the World's Finest. It was Batman meeting Superman. and they have some adventure. And these ventures are very Silver Age. And there's always crazy things that happen. I know in a previous story I read, they had liquid kryptonite in their guns, and they sprayed Superman with this liquid kryptonite, and they had to drag him by the rope in a waterfall to rinse the liquid kryptonite off. Really, really corny stuff. And this one, Batman might shows up, and he doesn't like it that Superman is doing all the deeds and saving the day, the things that he's creating for Batman and Robin, because he's a big fan of Batman and Robin. Superman, he doesn't think is very cool. So he is annoyed by Superman, and at that point, Mixel Picklick shows up. They don't really mesh too well. There's a scene where Mixie takes syrup from a billboard and pours it on Batmite. And one of the greatest scenes in comics history shows up in here. And it's when Superman attempts to clean the syrup up by using his steel strong hair as a mop. And he's like spinning like a top on his head to clean the syrup up.
Makes sense to me.
Yeah. So eventually, Mixel Picklick is embarrassed and he disappears, and then Batmite goes away also, and they're like, I hope they never come back at the same time. That would be just awful. So this is one of my favorite books for obvious reasons. Batmite, he's like the best character ever, right, Martin?
That's debatable.
That's debatable. No, I really enjoy these World Finest. This was by Jerry Coleman and Dick Sprang as the penciler. They have a different flavor than some of the other ones. And, of course, Superman's in there a lot of times, so that's always enjoyable to see their interactions and, you know, how they react to these weird characters and weird situations. Like, they had a big old robot in this one with, like, mobsters, and they were controlling this robot. Batmite and Mixel Picklick is from the fifth dimension, so they can change reality and stuff and make things animated, and they create this monster and different things. So I enjoyed this one quite a bit.
No, that's cool. You know, I love old, like, Batman Detective. Like, Brave and the Bold and World's Finest are something completely different. And they have, like, the same themes, all four of those, throughout the Silver Age. But it almost feels like the Batman book, and to some extent even Detective, were a little more formulaic than Brave and the Bold and World's Finest were. So I'll give you that.
Yeah.
Good choice.
Okay, let's go back to Jay, your number two.
My number two is Detective Comics number 359, The Million Dollar Debut of Batgirl. This is the first appearance of Barbara Gordon as Batgirl. Not the first appearance of Batgirl, but first appearance of Barbara Gordon as Batgirl. And in this story, she's decided to become Batgirl. It really doesn't go into a lot of reasons why. And the first thing she goes out, time night she goes out on patrol, she's... Bruce Wayne is out in his limo, and he's attacked by the Mothman and Killer Moth, who are doing this scheme where they're essentially extorting $100,000 from all the wealthy people in Gotham. You know, they're going one by one by one. So she tries to stop this attack on Bruce Wayne, and of course Batman shows up, and she doesn't know who he is. It's really an interesting story because it's a two-part story, so this is twice as long as a lot of the stories of this time. I liked it because of, you know, the interaction between Dick, Wayne, Bruce, and Barbara as their characters. She doesn't know who they are. Going back to what, you know, Martin said, the sexism in this is kind of in your face. But you just have to put yourself in the mindset of those times. You know, I don't have any problems with it. But, yeah, she had it mentions that she has a PhD, but she's working as a librarian. Because, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, what a woman with a PhD would aspire to, being a librarian.
Well, she's probably got a PhD in English, so, you know, it's like me. I never used my English degree.
I don't know. It was a story I found interesting and entertaining. There's one section where it describes how she converts what she's wearing into her outfit. You know, she pulls her beret down, and that becomes her cowl, and her skirt flips around and becomes her cape, and she rolls these short boots up to become tall boots, and her handbag converts into her weapons belt. It's clever. And the writer on this was Gardner Fox, again, pencils by Carmine Infantino.
Yeah, and we talked a little bit about the sexism stuff. My next pick actually has both Batwoman and the original Batgirl. If you go to those, then you can definitely see the difference. I think even when Barbara came around, that stuff was toned down compared to what we had in the late 50s, early 60s.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a good pick, though. Yeah. Do we all have a copy of this?
Do I have a copy of it?
Yeah, the physical book.
No, I don't.
No, I don't either.
All right, I have a copy. It's not very good, but I got one. And I only got it because it was super cheap. I think I paid like $40 for it.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, as we like to say on Nerdy Legion, a toilet reading copy.
There you go. Or a toilet reading copy at CC's Pizza.
Yep, there you go.
There you go. So, Martin, you're number two.
So, my number two is Batman 153 from February 1963. Written by Bill Finger with art by Shelton Moldoff. Again, this is a team-up book. It is Batman and Robin and Batwoman and Batgirl. Of course, not Barbara Gordon. This is, what's her name? Betty Kane. It's Kathy Kane's niece. Yeah, the original Batgirl was a little bit different. She basically looked like Batwoman, with the dress and the cape and the long pointy ears on her mask. But using Robin's colors, because they're trying to use Batman and Robin, but to appeal to women. The important thing about this issue is that this is the first Batman book that actually has a single story running throughout the issue. So before this, all the books had two or three different stories that did not necessarily tie into each other. This is a three-part story. But all three parts are told in the same book. And, of course, that is important because that's how we read comics now. So that's one of the reasons I ended up picking it. But this is a Silver Age thing, so, of course, it had to fit the themes, and this book definitely does. The basic gist of the plot is that this alien, Zarn, comes to our Earth from his dimension, and he's staging these robberies at jewelry stores. Except for some reason, these jewelry stores have, like, giant replicas of jewelry just hanging around the ceiling because, it's the 60s, and that was the thing. So he manages to steal some bracelets and whatever, and after Batman and Robin have a run-in with him, they realize he's only stealing jewelry made out of silver. Well, when Zarn sees them there, he tries to stop him, but he doesn't want to kill him. And he runs away. Batman or Batwoman and Batgirl know that Batman and Robin are there. They go after Zarn, and Zarn uses his interdimensional transportation ray to shoot both Batman and Robin and Batwoman and Batman, and transports them to his world. Except, doesn't quite work out that way because all four of these characters are split into two. So in our world, their physical bodies are still there, but their spiritual bodies are also in Zarn's dimension. Batman and Robin end up fighting some bird creatures. Robin and Batgirl end up fighting what looks to be guards of Zarn's alien race. And as all this stuff is happening, we learn that there's another guy, a scientist named Zeebo, that has sent Zarn to Earth to steal silver because this interdimensional device uses silver as its fuel. On their planet, they call it Vox. Here, we call it silver. So he sends Karn to steal Vox. And so he reveals his plan, of course, because that's what every good villain does, is reveal the entire intricacies of their evil plan. While on Earth, Batwoman and Batman are getting progressively weaker because they don't have their spirits. It's just their physical bodies. But they find a way to bring back their spirit selves into our world. And the way to do it is very simple, gentlemen. What they do is they lift up the interdimensional ray and put roller skates underneath it because they're trapped in a roller skating rink that's no longer being used. They put roller skates underneath the machine, and they push it and climb upon it until it hits a manhole cover, because somehow the manhole cover gives this ray additional abilities, and they are able to bring back their spirit selves from Zarn's dimension into our planet, and they punch Zeebo and Zarn and win the day.
Pretty simple.
Very straightforward. By the way, I also mentioned I love Grant Morrison. Have I told you guys that yet? I love Grant Morrison. There is a scene in this issue that actually shows up in Batman Inc. number 4 as well. So that's one reason that I picked it.
Very good.
Very nice. Another one that I haven't read, but yeah.
It's great. It's a piece of history. You have to read it.
Yeah.
And laugh along the way.
Of course. Yep. So, my number 2. My number 2 is actually Detective Comics number 300 from February 1962. It's written by Bill Finger and Sheldon Moldoff is the penciler. It's the bizarre Polka Dot Man. Polka Dot Man. And you have to love Polka Dot Man because he's dressed all in white with, like, dots all over his costume of different colors.
Mm-hmm.
And he is in a gang, and they steal things. They do on-the-spot crimes. Get it? On the spot. But he actually has pretty cool powers with this polka dot costume. You know, he can peel off his polka dots, and they're activated electronically. Don't tell me how. But they turn into weapons. Like, one is like buzz saws flying. Another, they escape with a flying saucer that the polka dots expand into like a little flying disc. Uses one as the sun. And another is a giant bubble that they inflate around themselves and float away. Punching fists. All the dots turn into these little punching fists and is punching Robin. Sleeping gas is one. That's actually how Robin gets captured. They're trying to capture the polka dot man, and Robin actually borrows a jaguar to help him track the polka dot man.
Of course he does.
I didn't know a jaguar could do that. But he ends up getting captured, and the polka dot man actually forces Robin to send a note to lead Batman in a trap. Robin actually puts on the note a secret message. He pokes hole in the paper and actually sends Braille to Batman's secret message that it's a trap, where they're at, that sort of thing. And polka dot man actually gets taken out by one of the old Batarangs, the Bat Flare Batarang. And it actually has the polka dot man seeing spots after that.
Man, you should be a comedian.
Tell me about it. I tell my wife all the time. Yeah, it was one of these very enjoyable, one of these crazy characters. I don't even know how often you've seen this guy, but you haven't seen him in a long time. It would be totally ridiculous, at least in this costume, to see him nowadays. But it was a very enjoyable, and I love the jaguar. Because when the jaguar tracks him to the place, they said, oh, just put the jaguar in the basement. The jaguar isn't attacking him or anything.
So this is another one that I read, trying to figure out what I wanted to pick. This story is fantastic. I love Polka Dot Man. I wish somebody would find something to do with him now. You know, like, Tom King's been pretty good about throwing in some of these kooky villains, but they're just like a panel or so. They just pop in and out. I would love to see Polka Dot Man show up. Yeah, as you're giving a description of this issue, it reminds me of, I can't remember what issue it is, like 295, something like that. Pretty close to this one. But the first appearance of Planet Master, because Planet Master is basically Polka Dot Man, except his powers are like planets instead of polka dots. But it's like the same thing. Like, he throws a planet out, and it's like, you know, whatever, fisticuffs or whatever it is. It must be a Bill Finger thing.
Could be, yeah. And when you look at a lot of these Silver Age stories, you know, Bill Finger's name is right on there.
That's true.
Yeah. So
It's just not on the copy of the book, if you got one.
No. either is, you know, the ghost penciler, you know. Sheldon Moldoff is one of the ghost artists that his name didn't get put on a lot of books, and it would be Bob Kane.
Right.
And there was a lot of assistants during that time that didn't get their stuff, didn't get acknowledged in that way, which was a shame.
Yeah, well, Bob Kane used a lot of ghost artists because Bob Kane sucked as an artist.
He did. You remember that story when, what was he on, like, Johnny Carson show or whatever, and they asked him to sketch Batman live, and he knew this was coming, so he actually had a Bill Finger sketch, and he had it underneath a piece of paper, and basically he just traced the Bill Finger sketch live on the show.
Wow.
Yeah, he did that, and also on another case, he had somebody draw it in blue pencil.
Yep.
Which was not, at that time, was not camera, couldn't be picked up by a camera, like on a copy machine or a TV camera. So it, on the screen, on the camera, it looked like he's just a blank piece of paper, and he's just tracing over the blue pencil. So,
yep. Yes. Everyone should watch Bill and Me.
Hmm. Interesting.
Fantastic documentary. That's what it's called, right? Bill and Me?
I don't think that's it, but I can't think of the right name, sir. Maybe.
I'll tell you right now. Let's go to the DuckDuckGo machine.
It was on Hulu.
Yeah, it's on Hulu.
Yeah.
Batman and Bill, that's what it is. Yep.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And super sad.
I actually went to a panel at Baltimore Comic Con last year, and there was a guy that basically was one of the people that helped acknowledge Bill Finger for as one of the creators and what he had to go through and experience. And he wrote this book, but it was real interesting to see how he, you know, traced it back and what some of the truths were and what wasn't the truth. And it was very interesting, very interesting. And I can't, off the top of my head, I can't remember who he was or anything like that, but it was very interesting.
Yeah, they kind of go through that in that Batman and Bill documentary, too.
Yeah, yeah. He'd mentioned that. I don't know if the guy was a part of that or what.
Yep. You know who else was key to this was Neil Adams, which that's my next pick.
Very good. Jay, your number one.
My number one, Batman 156, the story Robin Dies at Dawn.
Yeah, so remember yesterday I said I'm down to like three that I can't decide. This was one of those three.
Yeah, this is great. Well, number one, it's got an iconic cover, and I don't have the physical copy of this because this one, the cover is so collectible. Like there's a 9.0 on eBay right now that they're wanting $715 for. So.
Wow.
That's actually, you said what grade?
9.0.
That's a steal.
It really isn't that bad. I don't have
$715.
I know. Yeah, this was also Bill Finger, Sheldon Moldoff, which they wrote a ton of stories, worked together. And in this story, it starts out Batman is encased in this kind of beam of light and transported to an alien planet where he starts encountering all these strange creatures and a living plant. And he gets caught up and he says, I wish Robin were here. Well, all of a sudden, Robin shows up and with a giant spade and kind of destroys the plant. So he's escapes. And then they come upon this stone idol, gigantic stone idol, that it turns out is animated, alive. It begins to chase them and they're running and they get to a point where they're kind of backed into a corner. But they're trying to lure him to step and fall into this chasm. Well, Robin steps up and starts throwing rocks and shouting at the creature to get him to attack him. And the creature picks up this gigantic boulder and walks. And he gets to the edge, and the edge of the chasm collapses. He falls in, but the boulder falls down, strikes Robin, kills him. And then we go in to Batman starts just walking around alone now. He's completely distraught, dying of thirst. And it gets to a point where a creature comes out to attack him, and he doesn't even fight. He just says, I'm done. You know, Robin's dead. It was my fault. I'm ready to die. At that point, he wakes up, and he's in a laboratory attached to this machine that they're using to test the limits of a person's stress, and it's associated with the space program. So they're trying to do this, how they can, you know, help understand how astronauts, the limits of their stress. And that's the first half of the story, and this is also a two-part story. Well, in the second part, we see how this affects Batman, and he starts becoming overprotective of Robin. And imagining, there's one scene where they're chasing some criminals and there's a giant crane. Well, in Batman's mind, he sees this as that stone idol that was chasing them, and he grabs Robin and runs away, and he starts start showing fear, every bit of what we would today call post-traumatic stress disorder. And as I was reading this, you know, two things thought rereading it. It's like, wow, this is really kind of ahead of its time for showing, you know, they didn't call it PTSD, but showing how stressful situations can affect a person. And it showed Batman in weakness, which is really something you didn't see a lot of, certainly in the Silver Age, of how this. And the second thing was, this was also a story that was very influential on possibly the greatest writer in Batman history, Grant Morrison.
You mean for sure?
In my mind, yes, but others not. And it put me in mind of two other times where Batman has been encased. There was one in Infinite Crisis where, you know, he's taken out and put in, and then, of course, most recently in the current Batman run, the nightmare sequence. That's not a trope that's, you know, just recent with Batman. That shows way back up in 63 is when this came out.
Yeah, so there's two reasons I almost picked this book. One, it was the Grant Morrison connection, but I didn't want to do all three picks as a Grant Morrison connection. But I think this was part of the inspiration for Batman RIP, so that is important. The other thing is, I know you didn't mention it as part of this because it's a separate story, but the thing is that even though it's a separate story, it is referenced in this particular story. The first story of this issue is Robin and the Ant-Man.
Yeah.
And the Ant-Man is kind of somewhat referenced in this particular two-part story. And, you know, I just talked about the book that I picked as being one of the ones that was the first one that the entire issue was basically a Batman story. Like, this is kind of a step towards that. So I think because of that, it's important as well. But you're right. This is, if Bill Finger wrote this, which he is credited, so I would, we'll just say he is. This is a completely different kind of story than what Bill Finger writes generally in a Batman book. And I think that is important because it does set a tone for what's to come in Batman. Yes. This is a fantastic issue.
I agree.
Yes, it's a good issue. I just recently read this one when I was researching. Of course, you know, a lot of the Grant Morrison stuff is in the Black Case book. You know, they came out with right. this edition with all his stories, yep. which... be very, very interesting read. It's really cool to see, you know, things that they take out of the Silver Age or the Golden Age or Bronze Age or whatever and bring in stories. It makes you feel that these writers, you know, care about these characters and care about these stories when they bring, like, past storylines or pieces or even panels into the current story, so...
Well, and that's one reason I love Grant Morrison as well, Jay, because, you know, like, in order to write a book, I do think you have to have some kind of history, right? In particular, a character like Batman that's been around for 80-plus years. But, you know, Grant Morrison is very aware of that. And, you know, Bill, you referenced the Black Case book. I mean, Grant Morrison has, like, hundreds of references to 50s and 60s Batman comics. And I guarantee you, the majority of people writing Batman probably have never even bothered to read any of those.
Right, right, yep.
Right? So, and the reason to me that he's so great is that he's able to take these stories and be like, oh, like, this is a really cool element that nobody else has played with. Let's bring that into the actual continuity and make it work that way. Yeah, it's fantastic. In this issue, you have Batman, like, deciding to retire from being Batman.
Yes.
He's like, you know, Robin, you're on your own. And, you know, Dick can hold his own, but ultimately it's Batman that has to save him, right? And Grant Morrison kind of turned that around on its head a little bit. So, this is one of the best Silver Age books.
Martin, you're number one.
All right, my number one is going to be Batman number 217. This is written by Frank Robbins with pencils by Irv Novik and inks by Dick Giordano. And it is a gorgeous book from cover to last page. The cover is by Neil Adams. He was doing the covers at this point. I believe Frank Robbins, Irv, and Dick took over the book like 4 or 5 issues before this. I want to say like 211, 212. And it is a completely different book when that comes up, when they join the book. And that's why I say, just like you can maybe do Silver Age Batman books into the 40s instead of 56 and up, you can bring Batman Bronze Age from 70, 71 down to 69, early 69, when these guys took over. Because, like, the contrast between the creative teams is night and day. Like, you can tell this is a completely different era of Batman. And I should have looked it up. I'm pretty sure the changeover is between 210 and 211. Somebody can correct me later on. But it's around that those issues, between 210 and 212, maybe. And it's just night and day. Because before this you had, I think Infantino was doing the art. Matter of fact, you know what? We're going to look it up right now. Live on the podcast. let's see. 211, 210. All right. Maybe it's a little earlier. I know it's around this time, though. Whatever. It doesn't matter. Even like looking at Irv Novik's art, because one of the ones that I thought about playing around with was Batman 209, which is the Bat Tiger. I don't know if you guys have ever read that issue. And on the cover, it's got Batman with a tiger head and tiger feet. But if you look at the interior art, like, it still feels like Infantino or, you know, Bill Finger, any of these. Well, maybe not so much Bill Finger, but like Infantino, something more classic, like 50s, 60s Batman art. And then just like all of a sudden, in like issue 211, 212, just the art is different. It is like you're almost reading a modern book, right? For sure, like a book from the 80s. Like the art is like super crisp. The lines are crisp. It looks more realistic, right? You don't have that cartoony feel to the books. The coloring is a lot flatter. It's just night and day difference. Again, I don't remember exactly the jump in the art, but it's somewhere around 210. And go and look that up, and you'll see what I mean. The key thing about this book, the story is – I mean, the story's fine. I wouldn't say it's one of my favorite issues, but the reason I picked it is because I think this is a very important issue, because it is quite literally the end of the Silver Age of Batman. In Batman 217, Dick Grayson decides to go off to college, and of course it's going to have major repercussions for that character. Turning into Nightwing eventually. It's got major repercussions for Bruce and Alfred, because when Dick decides to go to college, Bruce is like, hey, you know what? We don't need to do things like we used to do it. Let's do something different. Let's make Batman dark. Let's make the villains of Gotham feel like they need to fear Batman. Let's bring back the old Batman. And that's actually a line in this book, right? Because I don't know how many people have read early Golden Age, but like that's what that book was about, right? It was inspired by The Shadow. And so you had this gritty Batman that killed people left and right. A lot of times using a gun, not always, but killed people left and right. And so Batman's like, we're going to bring this gritty era on. We're going to make people fear Batman, or bad guys fear Batman. And of course, it's kind of one of the things that differentiates the Silver Age from the Bronze Age, where you have much darker stories, more psychological stories. And in many ways, this is a very psychological story. Batman decides he's going to create this new program. Oh, God, I can't remember what it's called. It's like VIP. It stands for something. Victims Inc. Program, maybe, something like that. Where basically the Bruce Wayne Foundation is going to create this program to help people that have been affected by criminals in Gotham City. Right, like they'll provide them with like new job opportunities, with therapy that they need, and like this is unheard of in comics before this, right? But it's one of the things that sets off the Bronze Age, and so that's the reason that I picked this book. It's a gorgeous book to read. It's a lot denser to read than usually you would get out of a Silver Age Batman book, and it's just I think it's fantastic. Maybe not. It's definitely no action. There is no action in this issue. Matter of fact, I don't think you ever see Batman in costume. the only time you actually see Batman in costume here is Bruce finds this woman, this doctor. Her husband was killed by one of these bad guys in Gotham, and he wants to help her. And she doesn't want his help because she doesn't want the charity. But he's like, listen, we're gonna get you better. And he decides to find out who killed her husband. And you have this, like, the panels get broken up in two when Bruce is investigating, because he's never in costume. But as he investigates the crime as Bruce, you see this, like, ghost image of Batman in full costume on the right hand side. So Bruce is on the left, Batman on the right, and it's just freaking awesome to look at. I think just, like, the change in type of storytelling is 1,000% evident in this issue. And even going back a couple issues in this Batman run. So just fantastic. That's it, Batman 217. Go read it. It's great.
Very cool.
Nice.
So we get down to my number one, and it is Detective Comics 373. It's written by Gardner Fox and penciled by Chick Stone. Mr. Freeze's Chilling Death Trap. And this is actually the first issue that Mr. Freeze actually goes by Mr. Freeze. He was going by Mr. Zero before this. And he looks quite different. If you think he looks like Mr. Freeze like he looks today, he's like in this green jumpsuit with green gloves, and he has this helmet that has like a glass shield on the front of it. He looks quite different. As we get in this issue, you know, Aunt Harriet is in this issue, and she actually gets taken to the hospital for an operation. She needs cryogenic surgery, which, of course, we know cryogenic surgery. Am I right?
Of course.
Anyway, they attempt to do the surgery. For whatever reason, their equipment and Mr. Freeze's ray gun get shorted out by each other. For whatever reason. I mean, if you read this story to try to say, hey, let's see if this all makes sense. It doesn't, really. It doesn't. They don't say what kind of surgery she needs or anything like that. So Batman and Robin are on the case, Mr. Freeze, and they get to this point that we'll just take Mr. Freeze's gun to save Aunt Harriet because she doesn't have a lot of time left. And when you get to some of the encounters with Mr. Freeze, they set a trap for Mr. Freeze, and the one thing they have that I don't know if they've used recently is the, how do you describe it, the switch on the utility belt that warms your costume. So if you ever encased in ice, the ice will melt and you won't freeze to death or whatever. And another scene, the crooks and Mr. Freeze, his little gang, gets the upper hand with Batman, and they figure out that he has this little utility belt switch to warm up his costume. Well, they switch it to off with his, like, hands behind his back, and they freeze him and throw him off a building. Well, anyway, Batman is ready for anything, and he actually rewired the switch in the meantime. So off is on and on is off. So he was already melting the ice because he figured they'd find the switch. They end up saving the day. They get Mr. Freeze's gun. Aunt Harriet has her surgery. Cryo surgery that doesn't make any sense because if you're shooting Mr. Freeze's gun into her body, I'm sure you can control what it's freezing and what it's not. So one of the Silver Age books that I really enjoyed, and it's a fun story. Mr. Freeze's Chilling Death Trap, Detective 373.
Nice.
Classic key Batman comic.
Yes.
And I think that switch you're talking about on his utility belt was right next to the can of shark repellent. Sorry, that obscure Batman movie reference there.
Yeah.
Man, I'm surprised nobody picked an issue with The Outsider. You guys remember The Outsider when Alfred got killed and he became a bad guy?
Yeah,
they actually brought that back in the Flashpoint story.
That's right.
Yeah, pretty cool. So yeah, that's three of our favorite Silver Age stories. That was a lot of fun. You know, researching was a lot of fun, you know?
Look, I love Silver Age books.
Yeah, yeah.
Very underrated.
So, yeah. So let's go ahead and head back to the books.
To the Batmobile. Let's go. Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
You're ready to move up.
Let's talk about Batman and the Outsiders number 2. Written by Brian Edward Hill. With art by the incredible Dexter Soy. Colors by Veronica Gandini and letters by Clayton Cowles. Here's the gist of this book, guys. Caliber is not Cable. Ishmael is bat crap crazy. Black Lightning, not the best of leaders, but he's getting there. The end. Oh, also, Ra's al Ghul! Hello!
Yeah, I was going to say, how can you leave without Ra's?
Listen, I was trying to make it dramatic, okay?
Okay.
Because in preparation for reading this book, I reread the first issue, and we already teased this at the beginning of the episode, but Brian Edward Hill has educated a generation of Batman fans to properly pronounce Ra's al Ghul, not Ra's al Ghul or whatever the CW kids say. All right, here we go. You ready? Batman and the Outsiders, Issue 1. Page 25, okay, this new girl that the Outsiders are trying to save meets up with Caliber, who you think is Cable, but he's not Cable. He says, "Keep listening. Your father was killed by a man named Ishmael. He's a naughty boy, but he's just a muscle. Ishmael is following the orders of a man, maybe more than a man, Ra's al Ghul." And what does the girl say? She doesn't say, "Raz who?" She says, "R-O-Z who? Raz who?" And Caliber says, "Raz, period, ah, period, cool." Thank you, Brian Edward Hill.
There you go. You learn something every day.
Correct. Damn it, now I got to go back to issue 2. And it doesn't matter, whatever. I remember the issue. Because it's pretty straightforward. It's a very action-packed issue. Not a whole lot of dialogue. I think issue 1 had a lot more dialogue than issue 2. But really interesting. You know, we've met this girl. You know, her father was killed in issue 1. That's when we met Ishmael. But we meet this girl that has these abilities that were given to her. But basically, like, rich Gothamites, right? That wanted to figure out how to give people metahuman abilities. So they were experimenting on people. And she's basically the only survivor, or so we thought. This guy, Ishmael, has been after her because Ra's al Ghul is really interested in using her abilities. She's got, like, basically super strength and super healing. But if I'm not mistaken, her abilities are, like, kind of proportionately related to, like, a physical stress. Right, so presumably,
yes, the stronger she,
yeah, go ahead.
She's sort of like the Hulk. The stronger she gets, stronger, the more stress that she's in.
Exactly, and Ra's is really interested in that. But we did learn some cool stuff about Ishmael, right? Because he's not just a bounty hunter type guy. He's obviously been enhanced somehow. Like, we don't know what his powers are. I mean, we could assume like enhanced agility and things like that based on the way he fights. But, like, there's one scene in issue 2, or one panel in issue 2, where Tatsu cuts off his arm, and he just, like, flies up in the air and, like, regrows his arm in real time. And I was like, oh, my God, that is so cool. And that's one thing I love about Brian Edward Hill, right? So I've been following this guy since his Top Cow days, which he still works for Top Cow. But, like, that's where he started. I think he was one of the pilot season guys, actually. He was doing Postal and a couple other books. And, like, he's got this, like, love for sci-fi. And he always injects these sci-fi elements into everything he does. And I think it's really evident in this series. You know, when we had the – I can't remember what the arc of Detective was when he took over. But it's the one that introduced the Outsiders to the Rebirth universe. It read a lot more like a typical Bat Family book would. This one has some of those elements, but, like, there is so much going on in this book. because every single character, at least in terms of the main team, is completely broken. Completely broken. Mm-hmm. But that's the reason they're together, right? So every issue really has started off with Batman talking to Black Lightning, either about how to lead the team or about particular members of the team. And this one has some really cool elements where, like, Bruce is talking to Black Lightning about that stuff, but he's kind of, like, letting go of this thing already, right? Like, he's basically still financing, but he's like, look, this penthouse, it's yours. The team, it's yours. Like, you do what you feel is right for the team, right? Get to know your team. Show them that you want to lead this team. But he doesn't, like, really understand that kind of stuff until he decides to talk to Tatsu, Katana, and get some help from her. Because, I mean, Orphan and Signal are basically children still, right? So the only adults on the team are him and Tatsu. And she's like, show them that you want to be here. Right, show them that you want to lead this team, and show them that we're in this together. Because he hasn't shown them that, right? Throughout that Arkham Detective, we didn't see that. In issue one, we didn't really see that. And when they don't do what he says, he gets pissed. But really, like, it's up to him, right? Because as leader of the team, he needs to be the example. And if he doesn't follow his own advice, then these kids that have never really been a part of a team are going to do whatever they want, because they're going to be like, oh, this guy's a flake, whatever, you know, like, we'll just go do this other thing, right? Like, what the hell does he know? And I think that whole element of this book is really interesting, because we're basically seeing a team being formed from the ground up. A lot of times when we have team books, we don't have that, right? Like, they're already formed, they've been fighting together for a while, like, you might see new characters join in, but, like, there was already a core, right? Here, there is no core. The core is Batman, and Batman has put these people together so they can fix each other. Because God knows he doesn't want them to go in a sanctuary, because they'll go crazy there. You know what I mean?
Right.
That experiment didn't work. Let's just try a new experiment. And I love this book. Towards the end, you know, the Outsiders and Caliber fight Ishmael. He ends up talking to this girl through the whole fight, and my assumption is she decides to join Ishmael. We don't see that happen, but he does ask her, like, he does the Terminator 2, right? Like, oh God, what does the Terminator say? Come with me or die. Come with me if you want to live. Like, that's basically what he says, right? Come with me if you take my hand if you want to live. And then we cut to, like, the after the fight, and then we see her in Kadeem that we've talked about this entire episode, and there shows up Ra's al Ghul saying, like, hey, I'm going to help you achieve your potential. I will show you how to use your abilities. And it was awesome. Like, I love Ra's. I love Brian Edward Hill. Dexter Soy, like, he's always great, but for some reason I feel like Dexter Soy, this might be the best book he's ever done. It's not a perfect book. It's not, like, super heavy. But there is so much to love about this. I can't wait for the next issue. I almost feel like I want to write DC. I wish DC still, like, really did a letters column, you know? Like, I would write DC and be like, look, I don't care what you do with the rest of the line. You can do your 20-page books. But Batman and the Outsiders needs to be, like, a 40-page book every week. I love it. And now I'm a huge fan of the original book. So,
right.
You know, I think to me that says a lot. That I love this much, this book as much as I do.
Yeah, first of all, I wanted to say thank you to the people on Twitter who voted for this book, because this is not a title I had planned on reading, simply because I read too much already. But yeah, this is damn good stuff, and it's going on my reading list now. And I kind of reiterate what Martin said. I love these broken characters together. You know, Cassandra is one of my favorite characters. And Duke is the Signal. Yeah, I was really excited to see him at the end of New 52 and beginning of Rebirth. And then DC kind of, in my opinion, screwed the pooch and didn't really develop that character. I mean, I think he has a lot of potential, and I'm hoping that we'll see more of that development in this book.
And the one thing that we're getting that I really like is characterization of these characters. You know, they're not just throwing these characters into the story you know, you're getting scenes where you're developing, as he was saying, you know, Black Lightning is unsure about, he's not really have a bunch of confidence about leading this team. And it's like he needs Batman's reassurance. I mean, we've seen that the last two issues. You know, the one character, Caliber, I think it was pretty amusing that they kind of made you think it was like a Cable-like character, but he was like, yeah, if I would have said I'm this arms dealer, would you have came with me?
Right. And that's one thing that I missed that on, because that's how the issue starts, right?
Uh-huh.
So issue one ends with him saying, like, look, I'm from the future, like, the world's a crappy place in the future, and it all starts with you. And, like, if you don't get right, we're going to have this crappy future. And that's how he convinces her to join him. But then issue two starts with, I was kidding about that whole thing. Like, I'm not from the future. I'm just an arms dealer from Malkovia, you know, like, whatever. If I had told you that, would you come with me? No. So, like, that's why I did it. And that was hilarious, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Sophia is very conflicted character. I mean, her father just died. Her mother died before that. She's given a gun. She talks her way for Caliber to get her gun, and it looks like she's getting ready to commit suicide before Ishmael comes. But you don't know if that could really kill her or not, given her, we don't really know what her power set is. But, you know, maybe, because at the end there, when she see Ra's al Ghul come in, her face isn't, like, scared. It isn't anything. It's like, yeah, so I think that she came along willingly. She wasn't forced. Because she's not in, a prison cell or anything like that. She's in a bed in, like, a room. So I think whatever happens with this character, I think they're in for a fight.
I will say this. I made a hard push for Red Hood and the Outlaws, and I had a lot of people pick up that book. Matter of fact, I had one guy that messaged me. He's like, dude, just because you talked about this book so much, I picked up all 25 issues. Okay, this is when issue 25 came out. He's like, I picked up all 25 issues. I'm glad you recommended this. This is my new Red Hood and the Outlaws. I am recommending this so highly. I love this book. I think Brian Edward Hill is one of the most underrated writers at DC right now, and I'm glad that this book is out.
Absolutely.
Like, it might not be the original story he had, because I know they did a lot of rewrites between that detective arc and this book, but it's fantastic.
Yeah, I agree. So was there anything else you wanted to add about this particular book?
Yeah, go buy this book right now.
There you go.
It's great.
It's good.
So we'll go ahead and go to Stump the Co-Hosts.
It's time for the Batpod Stump the Co-Host segment.
And welcome to Stump the Co-Host. Our subject this week is the Bat Signal. Yes, the Bat Signal. So as always here on the Stump the Co-Host, I try to stump my co-hosts. Got two questions. You get question right, you get to have the cash and prizes at the end. And of course, you want the cash and prizes. First up is Jay. So the Bat Signal has shown up several stories for the first time. You know, a retelling of the Bat Signal, how it was first used. It first came up in Detective Comics number 60. But I'm going to give you a list of four that the Bat Signal showed up for the first time in other stories. And one of these I made up. Identify the one that I made up. A, Batman Family number 4. B, Batman the Man Who Laughs. C, the Mad Monk miniseries. Or D, Batman Confidential, the Lovers and Madman story arc. So which one of those did the Bat Signal not show up as a first-time introduction?
I'm going to say Batman Confidential.
And you are incorrect. In the Batman Confidential, the Lovers and Madman storyline, Joker actually created the Bat Signal for the first time to get Batman's attention. Gordon didn't make it. Joker created the Bat Signal. In the Mad Monk miniseries, Gordon initially uses a pager until Batman threw it out and said, we need something else. My signal can't be buzzing when I'm staking out some criminals. And then in Batman, the Man Who Laughs, it was introduced after the first encounter with the Joker. And Batman Family number 4, I threw that in there. I made that one up. 0-1.
So Batman should still have a pager.
Maybe.
That is hilarious. Like, I just see that him lurking in the shadows somewhere and that pager going off. And
Hey, they have the Outsiders have pagers. They all have the Apple Watches.
Right. Okay, Martin, got your question.
Yay.
And there's been villains that has taken over the Bat Signal and did something with it in the past. So I got 4 instances where villains have done something with the Bat Signal. You're going to tell me which one is the fake. A, Signal Man traps Batman inside the Bat Signal. B, some crime bosses show the Bat Signal upside down to call Batman for help. C, the Scarecrow changes the Bat Signal to look like a jack-o'-lantern. Or D, the Joker changes the Bat Signal to look like a big, smiling Joker face.
All right, so I know it's not A, because A is one of my favorite Detective Comics. The villain is Signal Man.
Yes.
I think it's the name of the issue.
Detective Comics 466.
466, yep, fantastic. The crime boss thing sounds like a typical Batman story, so we're going to not do that. You had...
Scarecrow changes the Bat Signal to look like a jack-o'-lantern, and Joker changes it to look like a big, smiling Joker face.
Oh, man. I'm going to go with D. You said the fake one, right? D.
Yeah.
D is the fake one, because I vaguely remember something with the Scarecrow.
D is the fake one, you are. Correct.
Yes.
Well done.
So the crime bosses that project the signal upside down to call for Batman's help is from Legends of the Dark Knight number 6. And crime bosses are being murdered, and they go on in it. At the end of that issue, they turn the bat signal upside down, shown in the sky. So, and the Scarecrow changes the bat signal to look like a jack-o'-lantern in the Haunted Knight. And of course,
the Haunted Knight?
Yes.
I don't remember that.
What?
Was that an arc?
No, it was like a one shot, I believe. It was, Tim Sale.
I'm looking it up. Oh, okay. Yep. Jeff Loeb, Tim Sale. Okay.
Yeah. It wasn't like, it was done after their 2 series.
Their amazing other stuff? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
After that other stuff that was just average. Yeah. After that. I'm kidding, of course.
Ah, that long Halloween, so average.
So, would you like to know what you've won?
Yes.
You've won your very own Bat Signal. Yes, that's right. You get your very own Bat Signal. It hooks right into your car, or you can have it in your hand. You're ever walking down the street, you get mugged, you get harassed, or you get teased or something. You shine that in the sky. Here comes, not Batman, it'll probably be Nightwing or Robin, Batgirl. But if you use that too much, they're going to just send Batmite,
Oh, yay.
Yeah, they're just going to send Batmite, so you might not want to overuse.
So, funny story, my kid loves reading, and so she has to go to Barnes & Noble today, and she bought some graphic novel. I can't remember what it was, but I was like, you go look. I'm going to go look at the graphic novel section. And I bought myself a copy of Rise of the Superheroes, which is kind of like a brief history of Silver Age comics. But we went to check out, and she's like, I want to get a bookmark. So she goes and buys a bookmark and brings it up to me. And as I'm getting ready to go in line, you know how they always have the little items all over the place by the register. I see this rack. And what caught my attention to the rack was Dancing Jesus, which was a little bobblehead of Jesus. But then right underneath it was a miniature bat signal. So today I purchased my very own bat signal for $8.95.
Oh, that's cool.
Well, now you'll have 2.
Yes!
That's cool. They're actually making a pop figure of the bat signal I saw this week.
Yes, yeah. And also a Batman Damned pop figure with no bat penis.
Oh, sorry to hear that. I guess you're disappointed. So.
Yes, yes I am.
Okay, let's go ahead and head to our last book.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol, I can be incorruptible. I can be everlasting.
What symbol?
Something elemental, something terrifying.
Detective Comics 1005, written by Peter J. Tomasi, penciler Brad Walker, inks by Andrew Kennessy, colorist Nathan Fabian. This is the conclusion of the arc featuring Arkham Knight, which is Astrid Arkham, the daughter of Jeremiah Arkham, what we had not seen previous to this arc. And this begins Astrid and all of her army. They've pretty much made a fortress out of the Gotham Observatory, and Batman and Robin are beginning to lay siege to their position. And so first they have to fight their way through a group of archers who are firing arrows through a smoke screen. Then Arcane starts calling up Unmen, which is a sort of rotted vegetation, as he's building these walls around the observatory. And Batman starts to fight his way through that, and it's growing so fast that he can't keep up. So he sends Robin to deal with Arcane. We also, Batman has to fight off Phosphorus, Mr. Phosphorus. And all the while, Astrid is getting ready, putting the final touches on doing what she calls totality, which we had seen this bright sun-like object that they did early on. Well, this is going to be one that is much greater. And Batman and Robin don't get there quite in time before she activates this thing. And it sends out this wave that not only is light, but it also has a percussive effect. And it covers the whole city, starts to blind people. Batman and Robin, of course, have their protective vision, but Batman's fails. He has to kind of rely on Robin to help him, but there's a confrontation here where Batman confronts Astrid, and of course she's railing on the city will be better as soon as he's dead, and you know all the hatred and anger that she feels towards Batman because she thinks he killed her mother, essentially just runs, tackles her, they fall over a balcony and into this lens, this mirror that's projecting this blinding light, which shuts that off. She's captured. Batman is still blind for some days afterwards. Has to rely on Robin, Damian, to drive him around in the Batmobile. And at the end, we see Astrid Arkham being transferred to Blackgate, but apparently she has got people that have infiltrated some of the infrastructure of Gotham City, and she's rescued from that, and we don't know what's going to happen next, but she will certainly be back in some future episode.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know how many times that Robin has driven the Batmobile, but he looked like he was enjoying it.
Oh, yeah.
Peter Tomasi, as we said this before, he really knows how to write Damian. If he could be the only one that writes Damian for the rest of time, a lot more people, I think, would enjoy Damian because he really gets that character.
Yep.
Yeah, there was a funny section in there towards the end where they're driving around and Batman says to him, "You do know I realize that you wave your hand in front of my face every so often." And Damian says, "Oh, I know. I just still enjoy doing it." You know, Damian is such a smartass. I love it. I absolutely love it.
Yeah.
And Tomasi writes him so well.
You know what would have made this issue better is more Damian.
Yes. The issue I felt was good. It wasn't spectacular. It was sort of just the kind of a formulaic ending.
Yeah.
You know, there's a big fight and it looks bad for Batman for a while, but then he overcomes and captures it. It wasn't a bad issue, but just like I say, something in there to make it a little more unique, like more Damian, I think would have made it a little bit stronger.
Yep, I agree. I am extremely excited for next issue, though.
Yes, I am too.
Oh, yeah, the Spectre. Yeah, that should be interesting. The other thing, this whole situation could have been solved by Arkham just telling his daughter that Batman didn't kill his mother.
Yeah, just show her the tape.
Seriously. I don't know. It sounds like we're going to be seeing this character again. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, she's interesting. I would I think it'd be cool to see her go up against Azrael, because they're, in many ways, I think they're very similar, right? their, I mean, not so much the actual origin story, but the way that they lead their lives, the imagery that they use, I think is very similar. So I wouldn't mind seeing like a Goth or whatever, Arkham Knight versus Asriel thing. I don't know like who would write that, but it could be interesting. Yeah, it was cool. It was anticlimactic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it wasn't anything that, you know, ended this and you're like, wow, I didn't expect that to happen. Batman, Robin went there, defeated her. There wasn't any real... I have to wonder what Robin put in, you know, the one villain's mouth. Or Kane got something put in his mouth and he, like, foamed over. But he's kind of undead anyway, so...
One thought I had was kind of interesting. That the point where he's trying to commit to tell her, I didn't kill your mother. I would have found it fascinating if she had said, yes, I know. I've known all along you didn't kill my mother, and it doesn't matter. That would be, now, why would she, how would that affect her motivation? That would say, okay, she really is pretty nuts.
Well, I don't know if it would affect that much, because doesn't she view as, like, all the villains as family? Because it's like Uncle Joker and, you know... Cousin Sarah Scarecrow or whatever. So the art in this was pretty spectacular, but I have one little nitpick, and that is, that must be the hottest coffee ever. Do you see the steam of the coffee, the way it's drawn? It's like
dry ice on it.
It's like the way it's steaming up in this little, I don't know. But it was good art. I do like seeing Batman with the little eyeglass that are in white in his cowl.
Mm-hmm. My slight nitpick with the art, and I've talked about this on other podcasts, is the crazy shaped panels. It's like, okay, I understand, but sometimes I think they overdo them just for trying to be clever. And sometimes it makes it a little bit hard to follow. It's like, okay, which were...
Here's my question. Do you think they do that to make people pick up the physical copy? Because when you read it on Comixology, some of them you can't see as well if you go to the panel view.
Right. Exactly.
And I wonder if they do that for that reason.
I think that's very possible because, you know, that's always been one of my personal reasons why I don't read more digital, because it's just not, the art is not drawn with that in mind. You know, it's drawn entirely for the physical paper.
Or when it's, you know, a lot of times when it's a full page panel, you really, it depends how big you're reading, but you really have to zoom into areas sometimes. It all depends how you read it or whatever.
We got to do what Bill Finger used to do and draw the arrows on the panels. So you know the direction to read in.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
Now, so, I don't mind it. You can usually kind of tell from the dialogue.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, yeah. I enjoyed this. I mean, Peter Tomasi, I've enjoyed everything he's written here on this detective. And I'm really, as I said, I'm really interested in the next issue. I know we got our copy of it, but I didn't read it intentionally before we talked about this book, because I didn't want that to influence anything that it said about this. So,
yep. Yeah, I didn't read it. I flipped through it. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Spectre might be my second favorite DC character outside of Batman. So,
okay.
I'm super excited.
Yeah. Yeah, should be pretty good. So, anything else you guys want to add about this book?
Nothing from me.
Nope, not from me.
Okay. We'll go ahead and wrap it up here. We are on Twitter. It's @bat_pod. We do have a email. It's batpodpodcast@gmail.com. If you have any input, any, what are your favorite Silver Age books that we didn't happen to mention, go ahead and send us what your books are, or through Twitter. or what you thought about these books. We'd love to hear from you. So, and final thoughts here. I think this is one of the stronger episode weeks with the books that we had, because Batman was pretty good. Batman and the Outsiders was kind of solid, right, Martin? Kind of solid.
You shut your mouth. It was fantastic.
And
I'm telling you, now that I've got you guys reading this, I'm gonna push for Batman Beyond next.
Oh, I was already thinking that, because the biggest thing that I wanted to do with this is that third book was talk about stuff that we don't have on. And in the past, we kind of kept it. We didn't really venture out too much. We did a little Batman Beyond, but absolutely, Batman Beyond is another book I'd love to talk about. You know, and we're getting some different stuff coming up in future months that I'd love to talk about. So, yeah. It should be pretty exciting in the future.
Please tell me we're at least going to consider talking about Curse of the White Knight.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Of course.
Oh, yeah.
God,
did you see
that Bane panel that he posted?
Yes.
Oh,
that's the kind of stuff I want to talk about, you know, stuff like that. And, I mean, we don't have to do, like, every episode about it, but, you know, when we get to, like, that's, like, 8 issues, I believe. We get to a key issue or something happens, we can talk about it, but it's those kind of things that I really want to. And we had Catwoman in for the first time. That's kind of cool. I kind of don't want to just leave it. It's the same 3 books every time. So,
yep.
So, yeah, pretty fun. So, is this like Martin's last episode for a while? Is that how this is? Yes? No? Hello?
Well, it depends.
Okay.
So the next recording date would technically be the 4th of July.
Yeah, that'll have to be different.
So, if we still record that week, I will still record.
Okay.
But that'll be my last one.
Okay. Forever, and he's gone forever because he's been fired.
For a month.
For a month. We might have somebody replace him. We might not. Ronnie Barron. And, yeah. We will miss him, of course. Not really. But, yeah, you know how it is. You know, he's going to be enjoying his CC's pizza and his Golden Corral. That's all he's going to eat, actually. He's going to do, like, a documentary, you know, what happens when you eat Golden Corral and CC's pizza every day for 30 days.
I'm only going to eat CC's and Golden Corral for 30 days, and I'm only going to read Deadpool comics for 30 days. It's going to be so amazing.
And then he'll want to change the name to the Dead Pod. You know? There you go. So anything else you guys want to add?
Nope.
So until next time, same bat time, same bat channel. We will see you later.